advocates of humanizing her were thrilled, although they worried that it was too late. The price tag on the Iowa campaign was already stratospheric. More than $25 million had now been spent. But no expense would be spared in the last 2 weeks before the caucuses. To put Clinton in front of as many voters as possible, a private helicopter was secured. The sleek navy blue Bell 222 chopper was promptly christened the Helicopter. And maybe, most remarkable of all, Chelsea Clinton would hit the trail in Iowa. She had done so only once before, a couple of weeks earlier, on the same day that Oprah arrived to campaign for Obama. Hillary detested the idea, fought it tooth and nail. Her protectiveness of Chelsea had been unwavering and fierce since the Clintons went national. Her daughter was an adult now, sure, old enough to make her own decisions. But Hillary was nervous anyway about throwing her into the middle of the mayhem, and if Chelsea made a mistake or was harassed, Hillary would feel the sting of responsibility. The prohibition against deploying Chelsea, intelligent, poised, and charming as she was, struck many of Clinton's advisors as nuts. "Is the daughter dead?" Vilmaine asked incredulously on learning that Chelsea wouldn't be accompanying her parents on their July 4th Iowa swing. And Chelsea desperately wanted to help, lobbying her mother insistently, enlisting aides to make her case. "She knows you don't want her to do it," Clinton's traveling chief of staff, Uma Abedin, told Hillary. "But she wants to do it. She keeps calling and telling me she wants to do it." Finally, Hillary relented. For 5 days leading up to Christmas, Hillary embarked on what the New York Times described as a likability tour of Iowa. She brought her husband along to vouch for her warm and fuzzy side. She brought her best friend from sixth grade. She brought farmers from New York to tell Iowans how she'd helped them. She even brought Magic Johnson to a few events. Gone from her speeches were any strident tones. Speaking as if she were on Quaaludes, her voice was bedtime story soft, her cadences syrupy slow. In a Des Moines grocery store, she told reporters, "I know that people have been saying, well, you know, we've got to know more about her. We want to know more about her personally. And I totally get that. It's a little hard for me. It's not easy for me to talk about myself." The hokiness of Hillary's likability tour was overpowering, and the inconsistency of it with her message all year long even more so. But there were signs that whatever Clinton was doing, it was working. A few days before Christmas, Hillary awoke to a new CNN poll that had her in first place in Iowa, 2 points ahead of Obama and 4 ahead of Edwards. On her staff call that morning, she was loose and frisky. Wolfson informed her that journalists thought her campaign had stabilized since the Register endorsement. Clinton agreed. "Obama's support outside Des Moines is thin," she said. "We need to start thinking about Edwards." She mentioned that she'd seen him quoted saying he was the most consistent candidate among the Democrats. Hillary scoffed. Edwards and Obama were very different cats, but they shared something in common. "Both were gripped in delusion," she said. If Edwards had any doubts about his sanity, he didn't have to look far for signs that would assuage them. The collective media assessment was that Iowa was still a down-to-the-wire three-way race, with an Edwards victory no less plausible than a Clinton or Obama win. In one 24-hour stretch in mid-December, Edwards graced the cover of Newsweek, looking serious and determined, sleeves rolled up, tie loosened, flanked by the headline, "The Sleeper," appeared the same morning on This Week with George Stephanopoulos and Face the Nation, and received the endorsement of Iowa Governor Chet Culver's wife, Mary, whose preference was seen by some as a proxy for her husband, who had pledged to stay neutral. Edwards was bolstered on the trail by the presence of his children and Elizabeth, who had returned to the road after a month-long absence. During the 4 long weeks of her hiatus, John's advisors had fielded countless press calls asking about her health. Had it taken a turn for the worse? But now, here she was, back on the hustings, as feisty and outspoken as ever, monitoring the debates, turning up on cable television, receiving wild cheers at rallies. Everything seemed to be back to normal. Then, the Inquirer struck again. On December 18th, the tabloid published a follow-up to its October expose on Edwards' affair, and this one was a doozy. Whereas the first Inquirer story had failed to name Riel Hunter, the new piece did that and much more. It included a photograph of her 6 months pregnant and bore a headline that read, "Update, John Edwards Love Child Scandal." And it claimed that Hunter had told a close confidant, that Edwards is the father of her baby. Team Edwards had known that the Inquirer story was coming for some time. Fred Barron, John's friend and finance chair, had scrambled to coordinate statements from lawyers for the candidate and Hunter denying John's paternity, which the piece included. It also introduced a new character to the drama, Edwards' longtime personal aide, Andrew Young, who was asserting that he was the father. The details in the article around Young's involvement were as squirrely as could be. The Inquirer reported that Hunter was living in a rented house near the home of Young, his wife and children, in Governor's Club, an exclusive gated community in Chapel Hill. When an Inquirer reporter confronted Young face-to-face, he first denied his identity and knowing Hunter, this despite the fact that the car she was driving was registered in his name, before announcing the next day through his attorney that he was the sire of the unborn baby. Drawing out the obvious implication from this curious chain of events, the story noted, "Some insiders wonder whether Young's paternity claim is simply a cover-up to protect his longtime pal Edwards." The new Inquirer story rocked the Edwards sphere to its core. Crazy as it sounded, the idea that Young was taking the fall for John had the deafening ring of truth. An attorney in his early 40s, Young had a history of run-ins with the law and a rumored alcohol problem. Though he'd done some fundraising over the years, his main role with Edwards was menial: household chores, personal errands, airport runs for the family. His devotion to his boss was comically servile. One Edwards staffer liked to joke, if John asked Andrew to wipe his ass, he would say, "What kind of toilet paper?" Edwards denounced the Inquirer piece vehemently to his staff. On the campaign bus, he railed at the tabloid. "How could they fucking say this? How could they do this to me? How could they do this to Elizabeth?" Some Edwards aides believed John's denials, thought the story was too far out to be true. The campaign's press shop, as it had in October, moved rapidly to contain the damage. Between Edwards's and Hunter's categorical denials and Young's paternity claim, reporters would have a hard time advancing the narrative. The story might just be survivable. But other Edwards staffers decided to stop spinning the candidate's disavowals to the media, so certain were they that their boss was lying. Too many of them knew that Young had talked openly about having a vasectomy a few years earlier, after the birth of his third child, sharing details with anyone who would listen. A bit of math and a glance at a calendar made clear that Hunter had gotten pregnant around June, within months of the recurrence of Elizabeth's cancer, right around the time Hunter popped up again. Despite the terrors Elizabeth inflicted on the staffers, their sympathy for her now was huge. Elizabeth's presence back on the trail, however, created a situation of massive instability. Even before the second Inquirer piece, she had turned against Trippi and Jonathan Prince, her husband's deputy campaign manager. Prince, she was sure, had helped facilitate the Hunter affair. Trippi had lost her confidence by becoming friends with Prince. She was alternately paranoid about and jealous of their closeness to John, attempting to banish both advisors first from Iowa and then from the campaign bus. Before the final pre-Iowa debate in December, she insisted that they be excluded from John's prep sessions. John begged Trippi and Prince to understand. "Elizabeth is a little upset right now," he said. "She's going through a lot of stress." Edwards arranged to meet with the two aides secretly to get ready for the debate. After the story broke, things went from bad to worse. John and Elizabeth were fighting all the time, sometimes all night long. More than once, she announced to the staff that she could no longer speak in public on her husband's behalf or stay in the same hotel with him. Once, in the middle of the night, she woke up a trip director and commanded, "Get me out of here. I'm not campaigning for this asshole another day." At other times, Elizabeth seemed intent on convincing herself that Young was indeed the father. She ordered the campaign staff to assemble an elaborate chronology of the previous months, establishing the nights when Young and Hunter might have been in the same city. "When were they together?" she demanded. "We need to figure this out. How many times were they together?" "It's been a humiliating few weeks," Elizabeth told a friend. "I wish I could wring Andrew Young's neck." One night, in the last week before the caucuses, she and John had dinner at Azalea with Kim Ruby and David Ginsburg, two of the former aides from 2004, who had left the Edwards sphere in large part because of the looming threat of Hunter. They'd come to Des Moines with mixed emotions and motives to help their old colleagues handle the mammoth workload and to witness the final days of Edwards as a presidential candidate. They had been there at the start, they wanted to be there at the end, and they believed this was the end. Edwards had invited Ginsburg and Ruby to supper after seeing them at one of his events. He seemed touched that they were in Iowa, in light of the circumstances about which he knew they were better versed than most. "Can you believe this is Andrew?" Elizabeth said over dinner. "How has Andrew done this to our family?" She solicited everyone's opinion about Young and Hunter. Had Ginsburg and Ruby ever seen them together? The two former aides squirmed in their seats and held their tongues, while John sat staring silently at them from across the table. They left the dinner astonished by Elizabeth's Herculean efforts at willingly suspending disbelief. But as disquieting for them as the scene at Azalea was, even more disturbing was the possibility that they were wrong about how Edwards would fare in Iowa. What if he won? What would they do? What should they do? The thought was occurring in the minds of many old Edwards hands that week, in Iowa and farther afield. The mainstream media yet again was determinedly ignoring the Inquirer. If that trend continued, there was a chance, however remote, that John could win the nomination and thus deliver the White House to the GOP on a platter when the story eventually, inevitably, was proven true. Tentatively, unhappily, but soberly and seriously, the Edwards old guard began discussing their obligation to the party to come forward with what they knew. When should they leak the truth to the Washington Post or the New York Times? Which of them would make the call? 2 days after Christmas, Obama delivered what his aides billed as his closing argument in Iowa, in the basement of the Scottish Rite Temple in Des Moines. With a law professor's attention to detail and a litigator's argumentativeness, plus a hint of the defensiveness of a politician under fire, he included rebuttals to almost every criticism that Clinton had hurled at him down the home stretch. For a month, he'd been telling Axelrod he still wasn't happy with his response to the charge of insufficient experience. But his research team helped him solve that puzzle with the discovery of a quote from a source both guilt-edged and delicious to invoke. "The truth is, you can have the right kind of experience and the wrong kind of experience," Obama said in the Masonic Temple's basement. "Mine is rooted in the real lives of real people, and it will bring real results if we have the courage to change. I believe deeply in those words, but they are not mine. They were Bill Clinton's in 1992, when Washington insiders questioned his readiness to lead." For all Obama's confidence, however, his advisors were worried about Hillary's apparently strong last-minute push and Edwards's entrenched and loyal following. The Obama campaign's internal tracking poll on December 27th made the race a three-way tie, with Clinton and Edwards at 26% and Obama at 25%. The trouble was, the trend lines were moving in the wrong direction. By December 30th, the final Obama tracking numbers were Clinton 27, Edwards 26, Obama 24. But the Obama campaign was still phone banking like mad, calling thousands of voters a day. The calls, his team was pleased to discover, suggested more support for Obama than their tracking poll did, and they all had faith in their turnout operation. As he headed for his final event in an eventful year at Iowa State University in Ames, Obama was exhausted. A quiet dinner with his wife was on the schedule for late that night. For all her reluctance at the outset, Michelle had poured her heart into Iowa in the closing stretch. Every voter who met her loved her. Her skill at inducing supporters to sign up had become legend. Michelle was competitive. She was constantly teasing Barack about how she was better at the game than he was. "I got 15 supporter cards today," she said to him. "What did you do?" What greeted Obama at Iowa State on New Year's Eve was a healthy crowd and an extraordinary piece of news. The results of the last register poll before the caucuses on January 3rd, ricocheting from BlackBerry to cell phone. Everyone had been on tenterhooks for the register's results. The paper's polling team was highly esteemed, with a long-held reputation for producing numbers of startling accuracy. And these were certainly startling. Obama, 32, Clinton, 25, Edwards, 24. The assumptions beneath the numbers were even more eye-popping. The paper forecast a dramatic influx of first-time caucus-goers, including a sizable block of political independents, with both groups heavily favoring Obama. On stage, a hoarse Obama reveled in the numbers. up 6 points, maybe it's seven, six or seven. It's beyond the margin of error. So we might just pull this thing off. We might just pull this thing off, Iowa. Who would have thunk it? For the rest of the night, the wails of Clinton and Edwards' operatives could be heard above the clink of champagne flutes all over Des Moines. At the 801 Grand Steakhouse, Trippi piled into the booth of every journalist in sight and explained in numbing detail the glaring flaws in the poll's methodology. Too many first-time voters, too many independents, a turnout model that defied the laws of caucus physics. In 2004, 124,000 showed up. The Register seemed to be predicting at least 220,000 this year. And Vilsack, who knew the caucuses like the back of his hand, took one look at the numbers and said, "That can't be right." The Clintons didn't know what to think. After all, the confidence that stirred before Christmas, their post-holiday return to Iowa brought back a familiar disquiet. Outside a church in Indianola one frosty morning, Hillary made a surprise visit to her press bus, bringing the reporters hot coffee and bagels, making a joke at the expense of her spokesman, expressing her sympathies with those who were away from their significant others, and was greeted with stony silence. "Why do they hate me so much?" she asked one of her aides plaintively afterward. Hillary had labored hard to comprehend the rules of the caucus system, and now she finally understood enough. Enough to worry, that is. There were successive rounds of voting, with candidates who didn't get 15% of the attendees at a caucus site forced out after each round. Her campaign had hoped to strike deals with Biden and Richardson to send their voters to Clinton if they failed to reach the threshold, but the negotiations had fallen apart. Hillary considered Biden and Richardson friends, though the former more so than the latter. Why weren't they being more cooperative? On caucus eve, January 2nd, Clinton's spirits brightened momentarily. Her final rally at the Iowa Historical Society was jam-packed, the music thumping, the reception for her rapturous. Backstage afterward, she and Bill talked with Vilsack and McAuliffe, both of whom were flying high, telling her she was either going to win or come in a close second. The next morning, however, an email arrived in Hillary's inbox from Penn. The pollster was hedging his bets. If turnout was similar to 2004, then Clinton would do just fine, Penn said. But if turnout was radically different, it would be because of another organization, and the outcome will be radically different. Hillary went apeshit and called Solace Doyle, demanding an explanation. "I'm as stunned as you are," her campaign manager replied. Hillary was still agitated when she got on her final pre-caucus conference call with her team that afternoon. Everyone else was tense and anxious, too. Curtly, she thanked the group and hung up. Then she hunkered down with her husband to await the returns. Around 7 o'clock, McAuliffe wandered over to the campaign's second-floor boiler room in the Hotel Fort Des Moines. 30-odd kids hunched over computers, monitoring the turnout numbers as they came in from caucus sites around the state. Every so often, someone would yell out an overall turnout estimate. 125, 140, 150. As the numbers kept climbing, 165, 185, 195, 205. McAuliffe started to wonder if something was wrong. He glanced over at Vilmaine. She looked like she'd been hit with a poleaxe. Wolfson, walking by on his way to grab some pizza, said, "We're gonna get our asses kicked." McAuliffe asked Vilmaine if it was true. She said it was. "Someone needs to prepare Hillary," McAuliffe said. "Are we going to get second?" "Probably not." Just then, McAuliffe's BlackBerry buzzed. Bill Clinton's counselor, Doug Band, had emailed. The former president wanted to see him upstairs and pronto. The next 4 hours were a blur for Hillary Clinton. Reeling from the loss, she appeared on stage for a televised speech surrounded by old and pale faces. Madeleine Albright, Wesley Clark, her husband, that created an unflattering contrast with the young and multiracial tableau presented by Obama. Back upstairs at the hotel, she had to be coaxed into thanking her Iowa staff and major fundraisers who were gathered in a nearby suite. "Yeah, okay," she said. Standing on a chair, steadied by McAuliffe, she told the crowd that everything would be all right. It was just one loss. The race ahead would be long. She was on to New Hampshire. But the expression on her face belied her words. With her frozen smile, her dazed eyes, she looked as if she were having an out-of-body experience. Returning to her suite, Clinton found it even more crowded than before. Chelsea was there, along with Hillary's mother, Dorothy Rodham, who sat on the bed looking inconsolable. Vilsack walked over to Hillary and apologized for having been too optimistic. "I'm sorry," he said. "I thought we could win." "It's okay," she said, but didn't mean it. Hillary began to pack her things. She was eager to put Iowa behind her and move on to the Granite State. But its primary was just 5 days away. The Clintonites had to decide, and decide right then, how they were going to halt the momentum that Obama now possessed. In particular, if they were finally going to go full-on negative, blasting him with both barrels, including TV ads. Most of Clinton's advisors remained uneasy at the prospect. And now there was the risk, too, of making Hillary seem a sore and desperate loser. "Can we win with a positive message?" Wolfson asked. "I don't think so," Hillary said. "I don't know what it would be. I'm open to suggestions." "This may be a movement," Wolfson said. "It's tough to beat a movement." Penn could barely believe his ears. "We didn't go negative here, and it cost us," he snapped at his colleagues. "This is what we have to do. This is how we're going to survive and win." Bill Clinton took control of the meeting. His instincts had all along aligned with Penn's, and now he'd been proven right. Hillary's team had told him that she couldn't win Iowa if she went negative, and she'd finish third. The hell with this, Clinton thought. He demanded to see the best negative television ads the campaign already had in the can. Grunwald sat down next to him on the couch and opened her laptop. Over the past few months, she'd made literally hundreds of negative Obama spots, not one of which she believed would have done them a bit of good. Bill studied the available options, then polled the room. Should they go negative or not? Penn, McAuliffe, and Vilsack said yes. Everyone else said no. It was nearly midnight now. An overnight flight to New Hampshire awaited them. As the suite emptied out, they all assumed that the negative air war would begin the next day, if only because the former president was adamantly in favor. Yet no one really knew where Hillary Clinton stood. She went back and forth. Throughout the campaign, her uncertainty at crucial junctures had been profound, but never more so than it was at that moment. All the past year, during which she'd been the undisputed leader in the race, Grunwald had reminded her that frontrunners never waltzed to the nomination. Somewhere along the line, they inevitably received a shock, an event that threatened to topple them from their pedestal, but which they almost always survived. Clinton was versed enough in history to know that it was true, but this felt more like a coronary event than a typical frontrunner scare. Sitting on her small private jet before it took off for New Hampshire, she leaned back and called Penn, who was flying in a separate plane with McAuliffe and the press corps. The confusion that gripped her went beyond questions of strategy and tactics, beyond going negative or not. It went to the existential core of her candidacy. In a voice infinitely weary, Clinton asked her Svengali, "What are we going to do now?" As Penn started to answer, his plane took off. Hillary heard only static. Chapter 10. Two for the price of one. She touched down in Manchester before dawn that Friday morning, January 4th, traveled north to the Centennial Hotel in Concord, cleaned up, changed clothes, then headed back south to Nashua to begin her 5-day sprint for salvation. Parlous as her circumstances were, bedraggled as she was from lack of sleep, Hillary took comfort in the steadier footing she had on this fresh soil. If Iowa was terra incognita for her, New Hampshire was terra firma, familiar, friendly, safe. There were no Byzantine rules to deal with here, just one that made perfect sense. Whoever gets the most votes wins. And hustling and rustling votes in New Hampshire was a Clinton specialty. Hillary knew she had to make changes, big changes, and had to make them fast. The near-universal assumption was that Obama's momentum from Iowa would propel him to a win in New Hampshire, where he'd already been gaining ground. A fight the previous year between states jockeying for electoral influence had pushed New Hampshire to hold its primary much sooner than normal after Iowa. No one could be sure how that would shape the dynamics of the race, but Clinton's supporters feared, and her rivals' fans hoped, that it would favor Obama, and that a second quick victory would all but ensure him the nomination. As Hillary's big red, white, and blue bus rumbled down Interstate 293, she thought about the advice that Bill had given her that morning. She should do more town hall meetings, take questions from her crowds, engage more directly with voters. That was how he turned things around in New Hampshire back in 1992, when he was on the ropes because of Jennifer Flowers, the draft, and all of that. Hillary could see the logic, though she didn't embrace the whole connecting thing with the relish that her husband did. It would be a mistake not to appear more open, not be more open, but appear that way, was how she put it to her senior staff on her early morning briefing call. But when her bus rolled into the airplane hangar at Boer Field, where her first rally was being held, she discovered that her New Hampshire team apparently hadn't gotten the memo. Her state director, Nick Clemens, ran through the program. Give your speech, pump up the crowd, don't take questions from the audience, hightail it out of there. Hillary shook her head and said, I'm taking questions. Clemens tried to dissuade her, said they didn't want to drain the energy from the room. Thank you for the advice, Hillary said firmly, but I'm going to take every question. Backstage, Bill paced back and forth, talking to their old friend Terry Schumacher about the uphill climb they were facing. We could turn this around if we had the traditional 8 days between Iowa and New Hampshire, he said. I'm just not sure we have enough time. The first person plural was no slip of the tongue. For a year, Hillary had been content to keep her husband at arm's length, but now she pulled him close. Nobody knew New Hampshire the way Bill Clinton did. He had been to every town and hamlet, remembered the locals and the layout, the demographics, where every cache of voters was stored. For the next 100 hours, until the polls closed on Tuesday, Hillary and Bill would run her campaign together. She needed his expertise, his feel for the state, its quirks and biorhythms. She needed him for his doggedness, his buoyancy, and his trademark Houdini juju. She needed him because even on his worst day, he was a font of ideas about how to win, as opposed to everyone else on her campaign, whom she increasingly saw as completely and maddeningly useless. Take the conference call that morning, for instance. For the first time anybody could remember, Bill was on the line, and what he heard confirmed all his doubts about his wife's operation. Here she was, hanging by her fingertips, trying to hatch a comeback plan, and there was her team, beaten down, barely capable of speech. Penn's voice was so thick and sluggish that it sounded like he was drugged. Silas Doyle was inexplicably absent. When Hillary rattled off her analysis of what had gone wrong in Iowa, they'd seated people under 30, appealed to older women at the expense of younger ones, made a big mistake in not recognizing that Edwards was an equal threat. Her advisors added nothing. When she offered remedies, they offered silence. We need to do things differently, Hillary said. We need to mix it up. More silence. This has been a very instructive call, talking to myself, she said. Goodbye. Exasperated though she was, only Hillary could resolve the open question from the night before. Were they going to run negative TV ads against Obama? She turned to Grunwald, a veteran of New Hampshire campaigns, including Bill's in 1992. Grunwald contended that there wasn't enough time to accomplish much by blitzing Obama from the air. Better for Hillary to throw herself into the New Hampshire mosh pit and body slam him there. Bill and Penn were all for the slamming, naturally. Penn's analysis was that, unlike Iowa, New Hampshire had been for Hillary all year long, and though Obama's big mo would cause some voters to shift to him, she could get them back, especially the women, if she laid out sharp and specific contrasts. A debate was set for the following night, January 5th, at St. Anselm College in Manchester, among the four candidates still standing after Iowa, Clinton, Obama, Edwards, and Richardson. It was there Clinton's advisors all agreed that she would begin her anti-Obama counteroffensive. Bill showed up at her debate prep session, another first, full of piss and vinegar. Still steaming over how Obama must have cheated in Iowa, he argued for Hillary to pop him hard with that accusation in the debate. Around the room at the Centennial, her advisors squirmed. It was tough to tell a former president that his advice was loopy. Hillary had a different idea. She wanted to whack Obama for his inconsistency on health care. And when debate time came, that was what she did. Obama defended himself, but not as stridently as Edwards defended him. Senator Obama and I have differences, Edwards said, but both of us are powerful voices for change. What will occur every time he speaks out for change, every time I fight for change, the forces of the status quo are going to attack, every single time. double-teamed, Hillary hit back. Making change is not about what you believe. It's not about a speech you make, she said. I think it is clear that what we need is somebody who can deliver change, and we don't need to be raising the false hopes of our country about what can be delivered. A few minutes later, one of the moderators asked what Hillary would say to voters who regarded Obama as more likable than her. Well, that hurts my feelings, but I'll try to go on, she said, with a wistful smile. He's very likable, I agree with that. I don't think I'm that bad. Obama glanced up from his notes and said icily, You're likable enough, Hillary. After the debate, Hillary marveled yet again at the insufferability of Obama's arrogance, and also at another instance of the double standard applied to the two of them. Can you imagine if I'd made a crack like that, she complained to her aides? The press would have guillotined her on the spot and played soccer with her severed head. That night, Penn publicly released a memo that questioned why, after Iowa, Obama and Hillary were still tied in New Hampshire polls. Its headline was, Where is the bounce? By the next day, he had his answer. A new round of surveys showed Obama pulling ahead to a double-digit lead. Hillary's donors were in a panic. Advice was gushing in from every quarter, over the heads and around the backs of her top advisors. Chelsea and Carson cornered Hillary on her bus, arguing that she had to be more accessible to the reporters, chatting them up, schmoozing them off the record, traveling with them, doing a press availability every day. Out on the trail, Hillary was doing all of that and more, almost pleading with people not to be stampeded into voting for Obama. Everybody needs to be tested and vetted, she said. The last thing Democrats need is to just move quickly through this process. Meanwhile, Bill was on the phone with Clemens, probing him about how they might make up ground, strategizing with Hillary at the hotel, taking advantage of a rare 5 nights under the same roof. The Clintons thought they were feeling tremors, seeing encouraging signs. Her staffers thought they were tripping. One likened the couple to a pair of dying patients delirious from too much morphine. Early Monday morning, with just a day to go, Hillary summoned Solace Doyle to her suite in the Centennial. What's going on? Clinton asked her campaign manager. Where do things stand? Solace Doyle had anticipated this talk and had been dreading it. The polling, the money, the press, all were deeper in the shithouse than Hillary knew, and the implications even grimmer. Someone has to be straight with her, Solace Doyle thought. Who else is going to tell her? But Patty didn't want to tell her then, not just as Hillary was about to head out for her last full day of campaigning before the primary. You're going to be late for your first event, Solace Doyle said. You don't want to have this conversation now. I want to do it now, said Hillary. Solace Doyle sat down across the table from her boss and sketched out the dismal picture. Penn's data matched the public polls. Hillary was going to lose New Hampshire, probably by a lot, and it was even possible that she would finish third behind Edwards. The most influential union in Nevada, the culinary workers, had decided to endorse Obama, which would likely tip the caucuses there 2 weeks later to him. After Obama's win in Iowa, African Americans were swinging hard his way, and given the size of the black vote in South Carolina, Hillary would definitely lose there, too. She had $18 million in the kitty to get her through Super Tuesday, when 22 states would hold contests awarding more than half the total pledged delegates at stake. But once she lost New Hampshire, her fundraising was bound to dry up, while Obama's would go through the ceiling. Hillary was taken aback. What do you think I should do? She asked. Look, I love you, Solace Doyle said. My primary concern is you and your future. We need to think about how 4 straight losses are going to look. You're an icon now, but if you stay in the race and embarrass yourself, that could be destroyed. Maybe the right thing to do is just drop out after New Hampshire. Hillary reeled. From the start, people had warned her not to put Solace Doyle in the campaign manager's chair, and Hillary knew well that Patty had her weaknesses, but she had decided to ignore all that, to disregard the risks because of Solace Doyle's signal virtue, a loyalty so fierce that she would run through a wall for Hillary. But after one setback, one lousy loss, Patty was ready to surrender? The person she thought would be the last to abandon her had turned out to be the first. She struggled for air. She struggled for words. She muttered a few things. I don't want women out there to see me as a quitter, Hillary said limply. Solace Doyle, on the brink of tears, forced herself to continue. If you're going to stay in, she said, you're going to have to make a show of shaking up the campaign. You're going to have to fire people and bring in some new ones. As they talked, Bill walked in and asked what was going on. Hillary told him that Salas Doyle was raising the idea that she drop out. It rang familiar. 16 years earlier, in his darkest hour in New Hampshire, some of Bill's aides had recommended that he withdraw. But his credo then was the same as it was now. Fighting hard and losing was honorable. Throwing in the towel was not. Strange stuff happens in campaigns. He had well earned his reputation as a survivor, and in her own way, Hillary had too. So much bound them together, but one ingredient at that moment was predominant. Clintons aren't quitters. As long as you have enough money for an airline ticket, Bill told Hillary, you should go out there and make your case about why you would make the best president. The Clintons were both running late for their first events of the day. Salas Doyle told her boss, we're definitely going to talk about this later. This isn't a closed conversation. Hillary went downstairs, got on her bus, and set off for her morning stop, a roundtable with undecided voters at a coffee house in Portsmouth. Huma Abedin noticed that Hillary seemed out of sorts, emotional and raw. Inside the cafe, in her sapphire blue pantsuit with the black piping, she sat down and took questions. Someone asked innocuously how she kept herself looking so good despite the rigors of campaigning. It's not easy, she started to answer, and I couldn't do it if I didn't passionately believe it was the right thing to do. You know, I have so many opportunities from this country. I just don't want to see us fall backward. The next thing she knew, her eyes were welling up, her voice was quaking, and words were escaping from her lips that sounded like they'd come from someone else, someone vulnerable. You know, she said, this is very personal for me. It's not just political, it's not just public. I see what's happening. On TV, the talking head said wrongly that tears were streaming down her cheeks. Salas Doyle was in a meeting when she heard that Hillary had broken down. A wave of guilt rushed over her. Fuck, I did this, she thought. Obama was on his campaign bus that Monday morning, rolling between events in Lebanon and Rochester, when one of his aides pulled up video on his laptop of Clinton's display. The members of his brain trust issued a collective snort of derision. Some called it a Muskie moment, a reference to Ed Muskie in 1972, weeping in the back of a flatbed truck in Manchester, thereby dooming himself in New Hampshire. Others thought Hillary was faking it, but Obama expressed some sympathy for his shaken rival. You know what, guys, he said to his team, this isn't easy. Then again, Obama could afford to be gracious. He was staring at a certain loser. The past 3 days had been an exultant blur for Obama, a march to assured victory. He had sailed into New Hampshire with the winds of history and destiny apparently gusting at his back. Everywhere he went, the crowds were massive, overflowing with lines of people stretching for blocks, waiting for hours in the frigid air to catch a glimpse of him, soak up his soaring cadences. Even the most hard-bitten members of the press were agog at what was unfolding before their eyes. Obama's donors were flying in from around the country to witness the coronation. Obama took it all in stride. This was how it was supposed to happen. The dominoes were falling in just the way that Axelrod and Plouffe had predicted. His brain trust told him about the offer that Daschle had conveyed from Edwards the night before, that the North Carolinian was prepared to drop out of the race and become Barack's running mate, driving a stake through Clinton's heart. Obama rejected the entreaty out of hand. By winning the Granite State, he could plunge that dagger in all by himself. What did he need Edwards for? Obama's confidence in New Hampshire was overwhelming and overweening. On his first day in the state, he declared to Newsweek, "At some point, people have to stop asserting that because I haven't been in the league long enough, I can't play. It's sort of like Magic Johnson or LeBron James who keep on scoring and their team wins, but people say they can't lead their team because they're too young." Obama had won just one caucus, but that didn't faze him. He was cruising now. In Iowa, his campaign had been relentless in responding to attacks. But in New Hampshire, when Hillary Land sent out direct mail assailing him for voting present on abortion legislation in the Illinois State Senate, the Obamans more or less let it slide. The candidate was too busy talking about hope to stoop to refutation. He didn't add a jot of substance to his economic message. This in a state where kitchen table issues were always paramount. He went from mega rally to mega rally, eschewing town hall meetings. All of a sudden, the narrative line of 2007 was flipped on its head. The insurgent candidate was running on inevitability. He was going to win because he was going to win. But if Obama was unperturbed by Clinton's near-tears moment, his brain trust was slightly rattled. The last thing Obama needed was people feeling sorry for Hillary Clinton. The suits cringed at Edwards's ungallant reaction. "I think what we need in a commander-in-chief is strength and resolve, and presidential campaigns are tough business, but being president of the United States is also tough business." Back at Obama's New Hampshire headquarters, Clough monitored the wall-to-wall media coverage of Clinton in the cafe. Now dominating the final news cycle before the voting began, it threatened to scramble the dynamic in unpredictable ways. Clough, his stomach queasy, phoned Axelrod and said, "I don't like this." Hillary didn't like it either. She thought it was a musky moment, too. Having labored so long to highlight her strength, to prove to the world she was tough enough to be commander-in-chief, she worried that she had blown it with one ill-timed display of the turmoil bubbling just below the surface. One of her aides tried to ease her mind by pointing out that crying had become fashionable in politics. "Bush can tear up. Mitt Romney can tear up. All the guys are tearing up." Hillary couldn't see how the analogies applied. "I didn't cry," she kept insisting. "It made you seem real, seem human," some of her advisors argued. But the realm of emotional resonance was, for her, a foreign country. "I'm an information person," she said. The rest of Hillary's day was no less eventful. At her next stop on the trail, a gym in Dover, she gave an interview to Fox News in which she responded to Obama's claim that she was denigrating the value of leaders, such as Martin Luther King Jr., whose stock in trade was the raising of hopes. "Dr. King's dream began to be realized when President Johnson passed the Civil Rights Act," Clinton said. "It took a president to get it done." Hillary's point was that words alone weren't enough to affect change, but the interview caused a flap on cable TV and the blogs, where it was cast by some as a slight against King. The Clinton campaign realized immediately that what Hillary had said was problematic, and she moved quickly to walk it back, inserting remarks into an early evening speech in Salem, effusively praising King. While Hillary was trying to dance delicately through a minefield of racial insensitivities, Bill was working the remote western and northern parts of the state. At a town hall meeting at Dartmouth College in Hanover, he uncorked the argument that he and Penn had been longing to make for a year. Hoarse-voiced and finger-wagging, he ripped into Obama's claims of anti-war purity and the media's complicity in letting those claims go unchallenged. "It is wrong that Senator Obama got to go through 15 debates trumpeting his superior judgment and how he had been against the war in every year, enumerating the years, and never got asked one time, not once. Well, how could you say that when you said in 2004 you didn't know how you would have voted on the resolution? You said in 2004 there was no difference between you and George Bush on the war, and you took that speech you're now running on off your website in 2004, and there's no difference in your voting record and Hillary's ever since." "Give me a break," the former president growled. "This whole thing is the biggest fairy tale I've ever seen." And Clinton was just getting warmed up. "What did you think about the Obama thing, calling Hillary the senator from Punjab? Did you like that?" he continued. "Or what about the Obama handout that was covered up, the press never reported on, implying that I was a crook, scouring me, scathing criticism over my financial reports? The idea that one of these campaigns is positive and the other is negative, when I know the reverse is true and I have seen it and I have been blistered by it for months, is a little tough to take. Just because of the sanitizing coverage that's in the media doesn't mean the facts aren't out there." Bill was infinitely pleased with his performance. "I thought that was good, didn't you?" he said to an aide as he pulled out of Hanover. Back at the Centennial afterward, he told Penn and others, "I finally was able to get the whole case out there." The morning of the primary, the Clintons woke up girding themselves for defeat. But Hillary kept working with manic intensity all day, scrounging for every last vote. She visited four polling places and a Dunkin' Donuts, shades of 1992 again, before noon, then interrupted an afternoon nap to cram in one last campaign event in Manchester. The rest of her day was a swirl of intrigue and whispered conversations. If Hillary was to be defeated in New Hampshire, the Clintons had decided they would hang a silver lining around the loss. For days before Silas Doyle suggested a shake-up, the couple had been discussing a retooling of Hillary's plainly dysfunctional campaign. After Iowa, their friends, associates, and informal advisors had started filling their ears with long-suppressed complaints about Silas Doyle and Penn. The chief strategist's bond with the Clintons was too durable for Penn to get the axe. "You're indispensable," Hillary emailed him. But Silas Doyle, her relationship with Hillary irreparably ruptured by their conversation the previous day, would be demoted, and a clutch of old Clinton hands would be imported to right the ship. Texan ad man Roy Spence, Bill's former White House political director Doug Sosnick, and Hillary's former chief of staff Maggie Williams, whom she wanted to run the show. Silas Doyle was getting ready for breakfast with a reporter when an email arrived from Hillary. Its subject line, "Moving forward. A number of our friends who have our best interests at heart have suggested that we need a new team," Hillary wrote with odd formality. Silas Doyle would retain her title, but would relinquish much of her responsibility to Williams. Patty read the message and cried. She'd suggested that Hillary needed to make changes, but never really thought she'd be the one to take the hit. Hillary loved her like a daughter, supposedly, Patty thought. Being dumped via email, the indignity was almost as bad as the betrayal. Pick up the phone, at least. Silas Doyle believed that she'd done a good job, that many of the campaign's flaws could be laid at Hillary's feet. She was prepared to take her share of the blame, but keep her job in name only and let Williams run everything? No way. "I understand," she emailed Clinton, "but I really don't want to stay on. I'll do everything I can to help with the transition, but I don't want my title. I'll just go home to my kids." Hillary emailed her back, "I don't accept your resignation." For the next several hours, Silas Doyle's closest friends in Hillary land streamed in and out of her room. Wolfson, Tandon, Ickes, Henry, all sat shiver with Silas Doyle, who alternated between disbelief and hysteria. Everyone agreed that if Hillary lost, they would quit en masse. Everyone agreed that it should have been Penn who was given the boot. By late afternoon, as word seeped out into the campaign, Hillary started hearing from those who thought getting rid of Silas Doyle would be a mistake. "Too many people in Boston are loyal to Patty," Ickes told Clinton. The move would cause too much chaos at a time when order, and the perception of order, was vital. Hillary hated personal conflict, avoided it like the plague, hence the demotion via email. But around 5 o'clock, she went up to Patty's room and knocked on the door. "Let's talk turkey," Hillary said with forced cheer as she walked in, trying to lighten the mood. And then, even more awkwardly, "Let's talk ham. Let's talk tortillas." The attempt at levity did nothing to lessen Silas Doyle's discomfort. Sitting down on the bed, Hillary asked her to stay. "People are going to leave if you leave. They need you around. You're the glue. I can't do this without you," she said. Silas Doyle told Hillary she'd think about it. What she told herself was, "I'm out of here." After Hillary left, Wolfson trundled in, bearing data from the first wave of exit polls. "Can you believe this?" he said. "We may only lose by single digits." Silas Doyle tried to be happy, but it felt to her like someone had died. Barack and Michelle had a bad feeling the whole day. Michelle was especially edgy. At lunch at their hotel in Nashua, though the polls had been open only a few hours, she dispatched Jarrett to Axelrod and Pluff's table to ask if they'd heard anything about how things were going. The first wave of exit polls from the networks late that afternoon began to provide an answer, and not the one the Obamans were expecting. The early returns from blue-collar Manchester were terrible, the first indication that Obama might have trouble with white working-class voters. The suits kept Obama apprised as the numbers went from worrying to scary to depressing. Standing in the hallway in front of his boss's suite, Axelrod said dejectedly, "It looks like she may inch us out." Jarrett came up from her room and found the Obamas swallowing hard to choke down the bitter pill. "What on earth am I going to say to make this okay?" she thought. But before Jarrett had a chance to open her mouth, Barak put one hand on her shoulder and said, "This is going to be a good thing. You'll see." Michelle was steelier, less reassuring. "This is going to be a test," she said. "It's going to be a test to see if they're really with us or not." In the Clinton suite up in Concord, however, there was less certainty that the primary was truly over. Hillary, who made a practice of never watching election returns on TV, was nowhere to be seen. Her husband, in a pair of jeans and a sweater, his reading glasses perched on his nose, presided over the room with his game face on, serious and concerned. Bill was closely monitoring the late returns from the Hanover area, eager to see if his broadside at Dartmouth had worked. But now, as he sifted through pages of precinct-level results, Clinton reached a dispiriting conclusion. "If Obama wins Hanover by 3-1, we're going to lose this thing," he said. One minute, the networks were about to call the race for his wife. The next, they were saying, "Hold on, we're not so sure." Clinton's knowledge of New Hampshire allowed him to be his own decision desk, more finely tuned than the network's data models and teams of analysts. Clinton phoned Clemens, from whom he'd been hoovering fresh numbers every 15 minutes all evening. A new batch from Hanover had just come in. "We're going to win it," Bill exclaimed. It was after 10 o'clock when excitement finally washed over the room. The networks had certified her win. Hillary came in and hugged everyone. "I felt it all day," she said. Bill boasted about how his fairy tale attack had been pivotal to the outcome. It had held down Obama's margins in Hanover. Racing out of the hotel, they sped to Manchester for Hillary's victory speech. "I come tonight with a very, very full heart," she began. "Over the last week, I'd listened to you, and in the process, I found my own voice." When it was over, Hillary marched down a hallway backstage with her husband and Chelsea at her side. She looked like a quarterback who'd just completed a last-second Hail Mary pass in overtime, pointing at her aides, high-fiving them, smiling from ear to ear. "This is amazing," one of them said. "I'm so proud of you. You did this. You did this." Hillary nodded and puffed out her chest. "I get really tough when people fuck with me," she said. It would take a while for Obama and his brain trust to figure out what happened in New Hampshire. The sight of Hillary being bludgeoned in the debate, her tearing up, and her gritty performance at the end, all of it while Obama was coasting, had done exactly what Penn said Clinton needed to do: bring home the women voters who had been with her before, but who had drifted briefly in the wake of Iowa, into the undecided column or into a flirtation with Obama. Obama's initial analysis was more rudimentary. Back at his hotel late that night with friends, he compared himself to a comet, and the next morning at a fundraising breakfast in Boston to Icarus, but his calm philosophizing masked a deeper disquiet about his situation after New Hampshire. The candidate wondered again if he might benefit from a broader circle of advisors, something he'd been pushing for, albeit sporadically, since the summer of 2007. His brain trust was gobsmacked. The campaign's internal polls had been just as far off base as the public ones. Clinton ended up winning by 3 points, and its strategy was in tatters. The momentum out of Iowa that was supposed to carry Obama to the nomination had been stopped in its tracks just 5 days later. With one win of her own, Hillary had changed the game again. Obama looked at the calendar and took no comfort in what he saw. Super Tuesday, February 5th, was Hillary's firewall. She'd been saying for months that the race would be decided that day when a gaggle of the big states where her support was robust would render their verdict. Obama realized that, for him to prevail, the contest would have to continue well into the spring, and he was already exhausted. In Boston, one of his donors asked him what the New Hampshire loss might mean. "It means I'm not going to get any sleep," he said, "and I'm dying to get some sleep." Chapter 11. Fear and Loathing in the Lizard's Thicket. The Boston headquarters of Hillary Land occupied 3 floors in a building that once belonged to the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service and looked the part. The place was charmless, soulless, drab, and gray, suburban office park neo-brutalist in every detail. The single homey touch was Solis Doyle's conference table, which in an earlier era had been the Clintons' kitchen table in the Arkansas governor's mansion. The day after New Hampshire, Hillary convened a rolling meeting around that nostalgic piece of furniture, beneath 7 framed covers of Time magazine that bore her image. The meeting ran from the late afternoon until nearly midnight and included a sprawling cast of characters: Bill, Chelsea, the original High Command, and many of the old guard Clintonites now being hauled into service. The only person missing from Solis Doyle's office was Solis Doyle. The staff had tried to find her all day long. Her whereabouts were unknown. Hillary rarely ran a campaign meeting, but this was an exception. She wanted to get her arms around the situation facing her in the weeks ahead. Having just staged a once-in-a-lifetime comeback, she should have been flying high. Instead, she was acting like she'd just been annihilated. She was angrier even than she was after Iowa, angry in a way that the old hands in the room hadn't seen since Bill's impeachment. She began with a seething soliloquy that lasted 15 minutes but seemed a whole lot longer. "I'm not putting up with this anymore," she fumed. Everyone stared down at their shoes. The sources of Hillary's ire were manifold, each more maddening than the last. A year into her campaign, her advisors were still squabbling over what her message should be. Don Baer, who had served as Bill's communications director during his second term and was now an associate of Penn's at Burson Marsteller, suggested she adopt a new motif, the politics of common purpose. Grunwald advocated an update of her husband's old theme of putting people first. Sosnick said that she should focus on the future. Spence argued for solutions. At this late date, it was as if they were starting from scratch. Wasn't there any lesson to be drawn from what had worked in New Hampshire? The Clintons thought so. Hillary had won because they'd attacked Obama, she at the debate and Bill at Dartmouth. The faction of Hillary land that had been pressing for months for her to show a softer side had a different view. Wolfson offered an analogy to the movie The Queen. You know, how at the end Queen Elizabeth becomes sympathetic when she displays her humanity, he said. That's what happened in New Hampshire. Hillary looked uncomprehendingly at Wolfson, as if he were speaking Portuguese. Having no message was one thing, having no money was another. Historically, nothing agitated the Clintons more than the prospect of being outspent in a campaign. The fear of it drove them to such extremes as the renting out of the Lincoln bedroom. Hillary had raised more than $100 million in 2007. She'd known that if she lost Iowa, her wherewithal would be strained, but she never imagined it would be this bad, that she would basically be broke. "The cupboard is bare," Icky said, "and replenishing it would not be easy." Clinton's donors were tapped out. "We have to win in order to raise," said her finance director, Jonathan Mance. "If we don't win, we're not going to raise." But Hillary didn't even want to compete in the next two contests. So certain was she of losing both, she thought it was pointless. Next on the calendar was Nevada, another caucus state. It would be like Iowa, only worse, she said, with caucus sites in the casinos on the Las Vegas Strip rife with fraud and abuse, and the Culinary Union rigging the outcome for Obama. As for South Carolina, turnout was likely to be at least 50% African American, meaning she was screwed. "You can't skip Nevada and South Carolina," Sosnick said emphatically, and the rest of the room agreed. With the campaign running on empty, losing two in a row before Super Tuesday would be debilitating and, who knows, maybe even fatal. Worn down, Hillary relented and agreed to play in Nevada, where both her team and her support among Hispanics were solid. A decision about South Carolina was deferred, but she could scarcely comprehend the situation in which she now found herself— gasping for air after just two contests, her campaign on the edge of bankruptcy with no clear plan for how to win. The person Clinton blamed most for her predicament was the one who wasn't there, Solis Doyle. Yet in the last 24 hours, Hillary had reaffirmed she couldn't afford to dispense with Patty after all. She didn't need any more instability, and dumping Solis Doyle would invite mayhem. She didn't want to deal with awkward questions from the press, and she couldn't risk a backlash among Hispanics over the firing of the highest-ranking Latino political operative in the country. In an awful lot of the states ahead, Hillary was relying on the votes of that community to pull her through. Solis Doyle had gone off the grid to think things over. She had little desire to stay, but Hillary implored her, and Patty caved. The next day, she resurfaced and began talks with Williams about finding a workable modus vivendi for their jointly running the campaign. Williams was busy with a consulting business and had clients demanding her time. Her appetite for being in Boston was as minimal as Patty's, but her loyalty to Clinton was deep. The conversations between Williams and Solis Doyle were uneasy and tense. Once, they had been close friends, the two most powerful women in Hillary land, Now they were the usurper and the usurped. It was a recipe for, if not disaster, then paralytic discord. Hillary, meanwhile, was gone, off to Nevada, South Carolina, Super Tuesday, and beyond. Winning in New Hampshire had given her new life, but had also allowed her to defer the hard choices required to right her operation. Salas Doyle and Penn were still in place, augmented now by a corps of reluctant conscripts. Nobody in Boston knew who was in charge. Nobody wanted to be in charge. In politics, though, as much as in the realm of physics, nature abhors a vacuum. And in this case, nature, or at least a force of nature, promptly stepped in to fill it. Bill Clinton picked up the phone a few days later and called an old friend, a member of Congress to whom he and Hillary had long been close. "I knew we could do it, and I was right," he crowed about the victory in New Hampshire. Clinton's friend congratulated him, expressed his admiration for the upset that Hillary had pulled off. But the congressman was discomfited by the way that Bill was claiming credit for the win. He urged Clinton to step back, to give his wife some running room. "It's her campaign, Mr. President," the congressman said. "You have to let her win this thing herself. You have to let go." But Clinton couldn't let go, especially now that the situation was so perilous that everyone was finally reaching out to grasp his hand. In the days since the Boston meeting, Williams and Sosnick had swiftly moved to incorporate him into the campaign in a way Salas Doyle and the other Hillary landers had resisted. For the first time, he was provided with a briefing book on the campaign's policies and plans. A morning conference call was set up to give him talking points and a read on the day's press coverage, and he was assigned the task of calling countless superdelegates, whom Hillary continued to fail to court. One day that week, over takeout Chinese food in the dining room at Whitehaven, Clinton received from the campaign's high command his maiden formal presentation on the road ahead. Hillary's newish political director, Guy Cecil, explained that they faced a lengthy war of attrition over delegates. For all the talk about Super Tuesday being Hillary's firewall, the reality was that, having poured so much cash into Iowa, the Clintonites hadn't conducted a poll in almost any of the February 5th states. In many of them, their operations were skeletal or non-existent. Cecil put a chart in front of Bill that laid out Hillary's best-case scenario on Super Tuesday. A net gain of no more than 60 delegates out of nearly 1,700 up for grabs that day. "God damn it," Clinton said, the familiar flush coloring his cheeks. "What are we doing?" Studying the chart, he shook his head. "All this money, all this work, and this is all we're going to get out of it?" The deeper Clinton delved into the workings of his wife's campaign, the more upset he got. But in truth, he was even more agitated about what was going on beyond Boston. Seemingly out of nowhere, the race had suddenly turned racial, with both Bill and Hillary being accused of insensitivity at best and perniciousness at worst. The dynamic had been unleashed the night of New Hampshire, when the talking heads on TV began to speculate about whether Obama's collapse in the nearly all-white state was due partly to racial factors, and the Clintons' comments of the previous day came in for closer inspection. The next morning, January 9th, the New York Times published a scalding editorial that accused the Clintons of running an angry campaign that came perilously close to injecting racial tension into the contest, citing Hillary's remark about MLK and LBJ and Bill's bizarre and rambling attack on Obama at Dartmouth. 2 days later, the Times published a front-page story in which South Carolina Representative James Clyburn, the highest-ranking African-American in Congress, echoed those charges, focusing on Bill and what he saw as a broad assault on Obama's candidacy. To call that dream a fairy tale, which Bill Clinton seemed to be doing, could very well be insulting to some of us, Clyburn said. Clinton's first reaction was astonishment, followed shortly by rage. Bill had been talking about Obama's record on the war, nothing more. Hillary had been making a historical observation, nothing more. Their words were being twisted, bent out of shape in a way that suggested that something more malign than mere misinterpretation was behind it. The Times made Bill especially mental. "I can't believe these assholes are sitting there writing this," he wailed to one of many friends he called that week to complain about the editorial. "After everything I did for civil rights in Arkansas, after everything I did in the White House, they know damn well I don't have a racist bone in my body." What cranked up the thermostat on Clinton's umbrage were signs he saw that the Obama campaign was stirring the pot with liberal media outlets and black radio and websites. A few days after New Hampshire, a memo surfaced, produced by Obama's South Carolina operation, that grouped together MLK, LBJ, and Fairy Tale, along with other race-freighted incidents, including Billy Shaheen's and Penn's invocations of Obama's youthful cocaine use, to suggest that the Clintons were playing the race card. Then there was Illinois Congressman and Obama campaign co-chair Jesse Jackson Jr., who went on MSNBC and noted that while Clinton had teared up in New Hampshire, she never cried over Hurricane Katrina. "Those tears also have to be analyzed," Jackson said, "particularly as we head to South Carolina, where 45% of African Americans will participate in the Democratic contest." To Bill, the picture was all too clear. By accusing him and Hillary of slapping the race card on the table, the Obama campaign was doing exactly that itself. And though it infuriated him, he couldn't help but respect the artfulness of the play. The Obamans were tough. They weren't just sitting back and letting the nomination slip away. "I wish our people were more like that," Bill said. Clinton could see the danger of the racial back and forth to Hillary's campaign and also to his own reputation. Seeking to contain the fallout, he made the rounds on black talk radio, clarifying his statements, defending himself, even talking up Obama. "There's nothing fairy tale about his campaign," Clinton told Al Sharpton on his syndicated show a few days after New Hampshire. "It's real, strong, and he might win." What Clinton might have added, if he were being candid, was, "But not if I can do anything to stop it." Obama and his brain trust arrived in Nevada determined to apply the lessons of New Hampshire. They would home in laser-like on kitchen table issues, from health care to the subprime mortgage mess. They would scale down their mega rallies and instead hold town halls and roundtables with average voters. But now they found a race bomb had been dropped in their laps, and it blew that plan to pieces. On Obama's first full day in the Silver State, the Sunday before the Saturday caucuses coming up on January 19th, the campaign learned that across the country in South Carolina, Bob Johnson, the founder of Black Entertainment Television, had become the latest Clinton surrogate to bring up, albeit obliquely, Obama's drug use. Defending the Clintons' record on race with Hillary at his side, Johnson declared that they had been deeply and emotionally involved in black issues when Barack Obama was doing something in the neighborhood, and I won't say what he was doing, but he said it in his book. He then went on to compare Obama to the Sidney Poitier character in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. The suits had no doubt that the Clintons were playing the race card, that they were trying to blacken up Obama in a way that would hurt him with both white and Hispanic voters on Super Tuesday and beyond. For the Obamans, the Johnson incident was part of an increasingly troubling pattern. "One thing is a coincidence," thought Gibbs. "Five are a strategy." Obama himself had not viewed Fairy Tale as racially loaded, though he was annoyed by what he saw as Clinton belittling him and distorting his record on Iraq, and MLK-LBJ hadn't bothered him at all. But the Johnson remark he found outrageous. Beyond his pique, however, he was worried that the simmering racial stew was on the verge of boiling over, and he was angry at his own campaign's role in turning up the burners underneath it. When he was told about the memo put out